Welcome to part one of Practical Management of Desmoid Tumors. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Ravine Ratan from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and on this initial segment of the program, we did a mini journal club reviewing a number of important recent publications and presentations on this topic. Accompanying this program is a slide file with the titles of the papers and key figures discussed in this conversation. We begin with a study from the Journal of Clinical Oncology presenting the long-term outcomes of patients on the Phase 3 DeFi trial evaluating the gamma secretase inhibitor nirogacestat.
The DeFi trial was a randomized, multicenter, international, placebo-controlled study for patients that had progressing desmoid tumors, where they were treated either with nirogacestat, 150 milligrams twice daily, or placebo. And the primary results from that study, which demonstrated a significant efficacy of nirogacestat in patients with desmoid tumors, were published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2023. So at the time that that study was done, nirogacestat didn't have a marketing approval for any indication. It wasn't available on the market. So we had patients on this trial that had responded very well to treatment and sometimes chose to remain on the drug for quite a long period of time. And the reason was very often that if they had come off the drug and then needed treatment again in the future, it was not clear that nirogacestat would have been available for them. And so they chose to continue taking the medication in consultation with their treating physicians and the investigators. And so as a result, we have this group of patients that were on nirogacestat in some cases for in excess of 4 years, which is, you know, not typical practice for treatment of desmoid tumors. We typically recommend a circumscribed course of therapy, although the duration of that is not really well defined for any therapy. But we did have these patients that were on for 4.5 years. And so this group of investigators, including myself, wanted to share that experience and show what happened to those patients. And so what we did was simply look at those patients that had been randomized initially to receive nirogacestat and then continued on nirogacestat in the open label extension phase and showed really that these patients do continue to take the treatment, that there was no new safety signals. So, you know, nirogacestat, even though we think of it as a well-tolerated medicine, it does have side effects, right? So people do have some GI side effects, very frequently diarrhea that's managed either with antidiarrheals or dietary modification. There are a number of other sort of skin side effects. There's a subset of patients that get hidradenitis suppurativa, and many of them actually have to stop treatment. And then there is this side effect, which was novel at the time of the DeFi publication, which is that patients treated with gamma secretase inhibitors also seem to have some changes in ovarian function. So periods become irregular. We see changes in female reproductive hormone levels. And so part of what we were also trying to show is that there was no new safety signal with that prolonged exposure to nirogacestat. We did see that some patients had continued deepening of their response on treatment. What's not clear, and it's really important to understand, is that we know desmoid tumors will sometimes continue to shrink even after you stop treatment. So what we did not show in this paper was that that continued treatment with nirogacestat is actually necessary to see those continued responses. It may have been that it happened even if you stopped the treatment. We don't know.
Could you kind of review the initial efficacy data in terms of response rate? How often did you see, a primary resistance and PRs, CRs, and how long the responses lasted?
Yeah. So at the time of the DeFi publication, the median PFS had not been reached in the treatment group. The response rate was 41% for patients receiving nirogacestat and 8% for patients receiving placebo.
You mentioned the 8% response rate with placebo, and of course that had been seen previously, I think, in the sorafenib study and maybe other studies. Globally, yeah. Right now, what is your take on, I guess you'd call these spontaneous regressions since they're on placebos? Yeah. I've heard higher numbers than 8%, but what do you tell your patients?
Yeah, so, you know, I think this has been an evolving area, right? So we've known for many years. In the sorafenib versus placebo study, the response rate to placebo was 18%. But, you know, there have been other prospective studies looking at surveillance as a treatment strategy in desmoid tumors that have shown that, you know, somewhere between 25 and 35% of patients may ultimately have stabilization or even spontaneous regression of their tumors if you watch for long enough.
So you were talking about ovarian toxicity, and this specifically was a paper from Cancer looking at ovarian toxicity. Can you comment a little bit about what they said and what we know about ovarian toxicity with this agent?
Yeah. So, you know, ovarian toxicity was not an expected side effect when the DeFi study was conceived. It had not been sort of reliably observed in the phase one or phase two studies of desmoid tumors, probably because it was a slightly different population of patients. In the DeFi trial, we were finally enrolling patients that are, you know, largely the patients who get this disease, who are disproportionately women of childbearing potential. And so in these patients, we observed pretty early on that we were starting to see irregular periods. The protocol was then modified to try to capture reproductive hormonal levels and more carefully interrogate this. Important to recognize that ovarian toxicity is an umbrella term for a bunch of different things: premature menopause, missed periods, hot flashes, and it can be very difficult to sort of bound those. So probably what we're seeing is that for the duration of time that people are on treatment with nirogacestat, they are likely having some level of impact on ovarian function. All of the data we have to date suggests that patients who stop the treatment seem to recover that function. What we can't yet do is go to a patient and say, we know for certain that your fertility is not impacted. We don't know that to be true. And so I'm typically having a very detailed conversation with a patient about the ovarian toxicity side effect, saying we think it's reversible. However, we have not demonstrated that fertility is not impacted. And we still do typically have these patients meet with the fertility counselor prior to initiating therapy with nirogacestat, just so they can have a full understanding of what their options are.
What's the typical hormonal profile of these patients when they become amenorrheic? They have elevated gonadotropins?
Yeah, they do. So, you know, FSH, LH are up, estradiol is down. That data, to my knowledge, hasn't been published fully yet, but I think that's what we've observed.
Any thoughts about sort of the mechanism? Do you think it's some kind of metabolic thing inside the ovary or toxicity?
All indications are that this is a gamma secretase class effect. It's not unique to nirogacestat. But exactly how it's happening, I am not knowledgeable as to why that is.
Any issues in terms of childbearing while on nirogacestat? Do you avoid pregnancy or is not a problem?
So, I mean, you know, with any of these agents, we recommend patients not getting pregnant on the treatment. And nirogacestat, that's true. So certainly on the DeFi trial, we required contraception or abstinence as part of participation in the study. We would never advise a patient to get pregnant while taking nirogacestat. I don't think the consequences of that are really understood at this point. That being said, there have been case reports of patients who have got pregnant while taking the medication since the drug was approved a couple of years ago.
So why don't we move on now and talk about the Ringside trial. It looks like a positive result reported in a press release that came out a couple of months ago. Can you talk a little bit about what varegacestat is and what we know about it at this point and this paper in particular?
Yeah, so varegacestat is another gamma secretase inhibitor currently being investigated for the treatment of desmoid tumors. The interest in varegacestat has been that this is probably a more potent gamma secretase inhibitor. It requires less drug to inhibit the target to the same extent. And the question has always been, will that translate to better efficacy, similar efficacy than nirogacestat, and will it translate to a different toxicity profile than nirogacestat? So the information that's out there currently is limited, but looks good. In the phase 3 Ringside study, in the press release, they pointed out a 56% response rate in patients receiving varegacestat, again, versus placebo, 9%, similar to the desmoid DeFi study where it was 8%, right? So, I mean, that's really positive. That is a number that is higher than 41%. Now, does that mean that it's a better drug? I don't think we know yet. I think there's a lot of details that I think we need to see when it comes to this medicine. What does the toxicity profile look like? What's the time to response? Do these patients get faster reductions in their tumors? I think these are all things that we're interested in understanding before we sort of say how this is going to fit into the treatment paradigm. But I think those were fantastic results to see.
And I guess it's interesting, as you say, we're going to need more data, but they comment on diarrhea, fatigue, rash, nausea, cough. I'm not sure I've heard that one before, but that most were grade 1 and 2. So we'll see whether this is going to line up. Yeah. Have you used this agent? Have you had any experience with it?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're investigators on the study as well. So we've treated patients in that context. You know, always a little bit careful. That's sort of what we put out there publicly when that's the exposure that we have. But yes, I've treated patients with this drug.
Just out of curiosity, is it usually a placebo control? So you don't know what they're on? Or sometimes you do?
There's only two placebo-controlled trials for desmoid tumors. Well, now three. There's sorafenib, there's nirogacestat and there's varegacestat, and those have all been randomized to placebo. I think, you know, the question I think will be going forward, if you're going to sort of have these stringent inclusion criteria where it's a 20% progression, will it be appropriate or ethical to still randomize patients to placebo? And I don't know that we know the answer to that yet. I think that when the DeFi study was conceived, it was pretty clear that placebo was a reasonable standard in the context of sorafenib. And even this Ringside study was primarily executed before nirogacestat was available. And so the placebo randomization, I don't think was as much of an issue. The question of whether that's going to be appropriate going forward, I think, is an open one.
We have two more papers that are review articles. A recent review article on surgery for desmoid tumors. They have kind of an algorithm in there. And then the other paper is on cryotherapy. Let's start out with the surgical paper. What do they talk about here and what's the bottom line?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's been very difficult to parse a message as to which desmoid tumors in 2026 are still appropriate for surgery as the primary management, right? So it's very clear that for patients that have, for example, an intradominal complication, a bowel obstruction or something like that, surgery is probably the way that you're going to have to address that. But for basically anyone else, you see real variability in treatment plans. So I think that there has been, based on an accumulated experience and interest in some places in continuing to do surgery as sort of one of the primary treatments for patients that have mesenteric or abdominal wall desmoids. And I'll be honest, at MD Anderson, that's still not our practice. And abdominal wall resection is still a potentially morbid surgery that requires resection, very often a full thickness resection, you know, a mesh reconstruction, maybe a flap. And so again, it's not free of morbidity. For mesenteric desmoids, again, there's always been this concern that if we leave that in place, like, could we have that erode into the bowel? Could it cause an obstruction? And so I think that there are some groups that are more aggressive about treating those patients with surgery. We, generally speaking, in our group, do not offer primary surgery to any of these patients. It's really uncommon at this point that we're recommending surgery. But this is an area of active interest. It's been difficult to sort of give a general recommendation for surgery in any location for patients that are being treated sort of outside of a specialty center, where sort of the nuances of this tumor versus that tumor can be fully appreciated by a multidisciplinary team. The one place where I would say that we really try to avoid surgery sort of universally, and it's reflected in this paper, is mesenteric desmoids in the setting of familial adenomatous polyposis. So we haven't talked a lot about that today, but FAP is germline mutation in the APC gene. Most oncologists are familiar with this as Gardner syndrome or a colon cancer predisposition syndrome, where patients typically have a colectomy by the age of 18. There are kindreds with FAP that are also very prone to developing desmoids. So APC, one of its roles is to facilitate degradation of beta-catenin. Sporadic desmoids have excess beta-catenin due to a beta-catenin mutation. FAP patients have excess beta-catenin due to a mutation in APC. And so the desmoid tumors are part of that syndrome as well. And we believe that it's actually the surgery and the wound healing response that seems to set off desmoid tumors in those patients. And so we are very reluctant to offer surgery to desmoid patients with FAP unless there is some sort of anatomical emergency that must be addressed.
So we pulled this paper reviewing cryotherapy. I guess it was in the same issue of Current Oncology. Can you talk a little bit about cryotherapy, when it's used, what are the outcomes? And
so, I mean, cryotherapy is an exciting sort of minimally invasive local treatment for desmoids, right? So the advantage over systemic therapies is that in many cases, it's a one-and-done treatment that potentially doesn't have the same level of morbidity as a full surgery. And, you know, we do a bunch of cryoablation in our practice as well, but it does require sort of that perfect tumor, a tumor that's in a location that's not near bowel, not near a blood vessel, not near a nerve, not too close to the skin, because one of the complications of cryoablation can be frostbite and skin damage. So when you have a tumor that's amenable to cryo, we are very often sort of quick to try to involve our interventional radiology colleagues. You know, I think that there isn't a lot of prospective data about cryoablation yet. Most of what we have is, you know, retrospective series or collections of series. But, you know, in our experience, the long-term disease control is quite good. And one of the nice things about cryoablation is that it's repeatable, right? So if you have an area that grows back after cryo, you can often treat it again with cryoablation. And so certainly on the menu for patients with desmoid tumors. It's part of the reason that we think these patients are best served at a multidisciplinary center where someone can, where people, a team can look at these and sort of disposition a patient to the best treatment. But I think this is up and coming. I think prospective experiences will be available in the future. And we are routinely offering this to patients that have tumors that are amenable to cryoablation.
So what about radiation therapy? Are there situations, particularly if you can't use cryotherapy, where radiation therapy is used, and is it effective?
Yeah. So, radiation has also got a track record in patients with desmoid tumors, and I think there are center-to-center differences. At MD Anderson, we do use radiation to treat patients with desmoid tumors. Generally speaking, we prefer to avoid treating patients that are young with radiation for a couple of reasons. One is that risk of secondary malignancies down the road, especially in patients that have a long time horizon. The second is that our data has shown that patients, this was a paper that was put together by Andrew Bishop, one of my colleagues, younger patients, and we drew the line at the age of 30, just seem to have less good local control with radiation than some of our older patients. But older patients in a location that's amenable to radiation, we do use that therapy, and it's on the list as well. I would say that given sort of how effective some of the newer novel agents are for desmoid tumors, systemic therapy still tends to be our first play. But in patients that don't want to or cannot take a medication, we still do use radiation.
Kind of a little bit surprising in a way that it would work. I assume the growth fraction of desmoid must be very low.
Yeah, I guess I can't speak to the biology of why that is, but we have quoted people 70 to 80% long-term control rates with radiation.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Ratan, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Practical Management of Desmoid Tumors.